General Moore, Real 4. The threat remained. There were times when intelligence reports caused us to wonder whether they weren't about to try something of that sort. And after all, it would be a logical enough thing for them to do. So I think that if it was a thing that caused me to keep a unit back and to worry about it without Darwin Goose Green, how much more would it have been a threat had Darwin Goose Green remained? And I think, therefore, that one couldn't really successfully and safely have proceeded against Stanley without clearing that particular threat.
How much offensive spirit and initiative had been expected from the Argentinians, do you think, before you got there?
As far as I personally was concerned, considerably more than was in fact displayed. This is quite an interesting little story too, actually, that remembering Montgomery and his caravan and his photograph of Rommel, perhaps, had sent for a report and things on this chap Menendez, who, when I discovered that that was the name of the guy who was commanding the garrison. And I studied it quite a lot and thought about it quite a lot and made up my mind about the sort of way I did expect him to operate. And I did expect him, in fact, to be really quite offensively minded. I expected him to operate vigorously and to use his troops to try and tackle us, because he had a background as a parachute soldier and a commander of elite forces, which one would expect to behave in that sort of way. And therefore, when we arrived and I found that this wasn't happening, I always had in the back of my mind this thought, well, is it going to come? When's it going to come? Where's it going to come? Is he preserving it to get something to back it up? And in any case, it must be the proper way to behave, to try to do something vigorous and throw us off balance, at least. So I expected it. The interesting thing was that I rather let my impressions of him from the report on him fade into the background the more one saw the way they did operate and the more one was able to assess the thing from what actually happened. And it was in fact only in Stanley, in the government offices, actually whilst taking the surrender, as it were, that I came back to the subject and thought to myself, God gracious me, you're nothing like the guy I thought I was going to be fighting. And now, you know, I've got time to stop and reflect. My goodness, you aren't, and you haven't behaved that way, and all the rest of it. In fact, the intelligence report I'd had was on quite a different Menendez. So, there were about, I gather, five of them in the... I've subsequently been told in the Argentine army, and I'd just, you know, been thinking about a different one. So I think everything told one, and even if it hadn't, it would have been only sensible precaution to expect them to act more vigorously than in fact they did.
It must have been an enormous surprise and relief to you that the actual landing at San Carlos was as relatively unopposed as it was.
I don't think enormous surprise would be right, because the landing, of course, in any amphibious operation, is the delicate, vulnerable moment. And we had always been quite clear that it was going to be very important that we get an unopposed landing, that we couldn't do a D-Day assault across a beach or anything like that. It must be a basically unopposed landing. It is interesting that it was only in the last short period before the actual landing took place that any Argentine garrison appeared in the San Carlos area at all. And when a company came up there and went into the area somewhere, it did become worrying. We used our special forces, of course, to locate where it was, and then we used other methods to try and confirm this and discover exactly where it was. And it turned out to be on Fanning Head. Now, Fanning Head is the headland at the northern, on the northern side of the entrance to San Carlos Water. And they moved in there. They were a small company in strength, I suppose, and were, in fact, on the night of the actual operation, attacked and taken out by an SBS operation, which did so extremely successfully. But we did know and had established for ourselves that there were either no Argentinians or only a very negligible number of them in the areas of the actual beaches we were going to land on. So I don't think that one would say surprise, at least in those terms. You know, I think our intelligence was good enough to not be surprised. On the other hand, it was a relief, was the other word I think you used, and my goodness, it was a relief that it so turned out, and that we had by dawn really got, well, we got the initial four battalions of troops ashore, of course.
Did it have to be San Carlos, or were there any number of places which would have been just as good to have landed?
Not just as good. There were a number of places that we could have chosen, and there were quite a few that were discussed in considerable detail. From a soldier's point of view, and it was the sort of questioning quite properly that I received from the Chief of the General Staff to probe why a landing 50 miles from your objective. I, as a soldier, wouldn't have wanted to land that far away. I would have wanted to land out of gun range of his garrison around Stanley, or any other garrison that had guns, if I could achieve that. And, of course, one could. But there were landings that were out of gun range, but much, much nearer to Stanley than was San Carlos. But, of course, one has said, I said just now, that the actual landing is the vulnerable time in an amphibious operation. And ships that are inevitably anchored and offloading are extremely vulnerable. Now, what are they vulnerable to? They're vulnerable to attack by submarines firing torpedoes. They're vulnerable to air attack using iron bombs. They're vulnerable to air attack using missiles. They are vulnerable, maybe, to mining. And they are vulnerable to the weather. So that's quite a lot of threats. If you take the possible landing beaches, and there were some good ones at a place called Cow Bay to the north of Barclay Sound and Stanley. The problem there was it was on the northeast coast. That's just the area where our submariners assessed it was most likely the Argentinians would have a submarine, and I think in the event the general assessment is they probably did initially have a submarine in there, that area. Whether it was still there on the day when we in fact did the landing, I don't know. It was a straight east-northeast facing coastline, and therefore extremely vulnerable to weather, vulnerable to submarine torpedo attack, vulnerable to iron bombs, because virtually anywhere was vulnerable to that, vulnerable to the Exocet firing aircraft, because it was off a coastline. So that really ruled it out. I mean, there was no question of going there. There were others in between, typically, for instance, Port Salvador on the north of East Falkland, which was a very large area of water inside a long, narrow entrance. Therefore, certainly protected from the weather, protected once you're in there from submarines, protected from probably from Exocet firing because there was land around. It was more low-lying land than in other areas, but there was land around, and I suspect that probably the Exocet would have been targeted itself against the land, which would have given them bigger echo than the ships. A bit vulnerable to mining, of course, of the entrance, but, and worst of all, in the case of Port Salvador, I think, this long, narrow entrance was very narrow in places, and if we'd had a ship sunk or lost or something in one of the narrow bits, it would have completely blocked the channel. Now, there was another one down south, Mare Harbour, which has been used subsequently in relation to, I think, the Mount Pleasant airfield complex, which had, you know, a variety of these sort of advantages and disadvantages. But San Carlos is surrounded by big hills and gave excellent protection from submarines, excellent protection from the weather, and indeed double those, because you go into Falkland Sound and then from that into San Carlos. And it's got a narrowish entrance. I mean, in those terms, it's a mile wide, I suppose, but a frigate could stop submarines coming in there once we got in. And so it was vulnerable to iron bombs, sure. We could have lost things going in to mines had they been planted there. But I think it was Alacrity, certainly one of the Type 21s, used to sail up and down that stretch of water every night, and thus would soon have found, expensive mine hunter admittedly, but she'd have found any mines that had been there, and so we knew that that was clear. So really it left us just threatened by the iron bombs, and of course the Navy took that problem on, as they well understood was their role, by taking the aircraft on with the escorts. And during the initial hours after daylight, when the Argentinian Air Force flew up Falkland Sound from the southwest, coming up the sound, and there in front of them they saw all these escorts. And in the initial hours at least, the battle, I think, really was largely between the escorts and the air forces, and we lost escorts. But as the escorts appreciate, that's what they're about. And what we didn't lose was the merchant ships. Later, all the amphibious ships. Later, when they did come over the hill and they found those ships, first of all, we had got all the Repyar missiles, for instance, out of the ships. And we got the guns and we'd started getting the ammunition out. And that meant that we were at least able to set up some sort of protection on shore as well as what there was from the fleet. That was the difficult and balanced bit, I think, between the Navy and, including, of course, the Sea Harriers as part of the naval effort, and the Argentinian Air Force and Naval Air Arm. It succeeded, and I think, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's very difficult to see our having done it with anywhere other than San Carlos. San Carlos emerged rather than hitting us all in the face when we started planning, but I think it became more and more clear it had to be it. And I think as the actual landing approached, the $64,000 question really was, what happens if they do garrison San Carlos?
Could you tell me how the actual terrain of the Falklands, as you found it in practice, affected your own decisions that had to be made about the actual walk or march of troops across West Falkland?
East Falkland, actually.
East
but
Falkland,
let's not
sorry.
Worry about that. Well, the terrain did not take us by surprise in the sense that, as you know, we'd had a Rommarine garrison there and many Rommarine officers had been there for tours over the years. We knew very well before we started that this terrain was not suitable for wheeled vehicles. What we didn't know was how well tracked vehicles would manage over it, because its principal, two principal problems, really, were, one, huge rock runs, great, almost rivers of tumbled, jumbled rocks. And by rocks, one's not talking about things the size of a football, but the size of this grand piano here, and bigger. They are huge, and they therefore are a very considerable obstacle to movement unless you have a lot of engineer plant to manufacture roads. And the other side of it, of course, is the boggy nature of the other parts of the terrain into which vehicles sink. And even the local tractors and Land Rovers, single vehicles, moving about, get bogged and have to be hauled out from time to time and tend to move at about 5 miles in the hour, I think, something like that. So that as soon, of course, on that ground of that nature, you start increasing the numbers, the problem magnifies many times. And so we were conscious from the beginning that we were not going to be able to use lorries in the Falklands. And therefore all our logistic support, and again and again it comes back to logistic support, even to the extent of, for instance, carrying men's packs and things, basically was going to have to be by sea round the side or by air, by under Sligon helicopters. We did have, fortunately, in 3 Commando Brigade, Volvo over snow vehicles. And we knew that those vehicles, designed for use in Scandinavia, are extremely good not only on snow, but also in boggy territory. And therefore, we took those vehicles with us. And the units that were equipped with them found them extremely valuable. Now, you only have a limited number of those. They are not a replacement for the complete wheeled vehicle fleet. But they do undertake many of the tasks in an infantry unit and an artillery unit and so on that would usually be undertaken by the Land Rover type of vehicle. And therefore, things like radio sets and things could be transported in a vehicle, which one meant you could get rather heavier radio sets to the places you wanted them, and B meant, of course, that you could do things like charge the batteries and so on in place, which made it much easier than it would have been without them. However, I don't think we need to go in this point into the helicopter usage, because we've discussed that in the other context. But the other thing that is interesting, perhaps, is, of course, with armoured vehicles. Because we thought about armoured vehicles, and we weren't sure how armoured vehicles, being that much heavier than these Volvos and things, would manage in the terrain. I think we thought that it was fairly likely that main battle tanks would not, in fact, manage the terrain, because they're so big, and 50 tons of tank, you know, is an awful lot. But we did take 2 troops of the Alvis Scorpion Scimitar vehicles of the Blues and Royals. And we took them on the basis that at least we reckoned we'd be able to get them ashore and use them in the protection of the beachhead. We rather doubted whether we'd even get them any further. We underestimated their capabilities. They were quite superb. They got virtually everywhere we wanted them to. Sure, the rock runs, they couldn't just take a rock run, but they could find ways round. And they found a way round through and over the mountains from one flank to the other. And they were absolutely invaluable. First-class vehicles, did extremely well. And, of course, the sheer capability of having an armoured vehicle with a much longer-range direct-fire weapon than the infantry have, with both their Raden and their 75mm, were excellent. There then arises, of course, well, with the benefit of hindsight, would it have been nice to have taken more? Well, of course, it would always be nice to have more, but where would we have fitted them? Shipping was very limited, and I suspect, whilst it would have been very tempting to take more, I'm not sure that taking more would have been a lot of help. Maybe to have taken a whole squadron and left out something else might have helped. They might have been able to provide some excellent additional fire support. But I think the real thing on the movement was that fortunately we did have enough intelligence to know what sort of vehicles even had an opportunity to work, and those were what we took. It's interesting, the Argentinians, for instance, took Panhard armoured cars. I'm sure they're excellent armoured cars, but they are armoured cars, wheeled, and they never came into action because there was only, as it were, one, no, possibly two little roads, tracks, really, that they could have come up. They'd have been on this single axis and exceedingly vulnerable, and I think we'd have pinged a lot of them had they tried to use them. They also had, their other vehicles were wheeled. They had Mercedes Jeeps, used them, and they did really quite well, but it wasn't suitable terrain for wheeled vehicles.
Would you say that you were lucky or not with the climate, with the weather, once you got there?
I think luck, fascinating. Luck comes into all military operations, and he who says it doesn't is making a grave error. Napoleon said, didn't he, you tell me this general is good, I ask you, is he lucky? But all that said, I don't take actually Napoleon's words at face value, and I don't know French well enough to know what the words actually were in French. It is my belief that luck indeed plays a considerable part in military affairs, but in the long run, luck plays its part equally, probably, for both sides. The point is who does and who does not make use of the good luck and cope with the bad when that comes along to take its turn. As far as the climate was concerned, climate in quotes, and the winter weather and that sort of thing, I think that served us better than it served the enemy. It should aid the defence, really, I think, probably, to have difficult conditions and unpleasant winter conditions. But we were able to use it because, of course, the commander brigade is trained in Arctic warfare and is extremely good at coping with the conditions. But I may say that whilst Arctic, in the sense of getting a lot of very cold weather, the climate in the Falklands actually is the one that is most difficult to cope with, in that it switches from above to below zero quite a lot. If the temperature switches below zero and then stays there for months, that's much easier to cope with, because you know where you stand, you know, and you've got it all the time. If you get wet one day and frozen the next, that's worse, and that's very much what the islands produced. The Argentinians were not good at coping with it because they were not trained to do so, and because they didn't, their administration and logistic setup was not as efficient as it should have been, and their men were not well cared for and catered for. Ours, much better. We would have continued to suffer from the bad weather, however, more and more, the longer we had stayed there. Anyone would, however well trained. The other aspect, though, of luck and the weather, which I think is interesting, is that, and really demonstrates my point about the weather coming, luck, rather, visiting itself on both sides. On the 19th of May, when the fast and slow amphibious convoys and the other vessels and so on all arrived together in the area where we were going to have to do the cross-decking operation, as we referred to it, that is to say, the movement of men, stores and so on, between the ships in which they had travelled to the area and the ships from which they would make the landing, which were not the same for all sorts of good reasons. The weather was right to do the cross-decking. Let me first just briefly explain, as illustratively, what I mean. The gunners will tend to travel as gunners with their guns or with their commanding officer and so on, doing their planning, and all the OP parties will want to go to the infantry they're going to land with. Secondly, for instance, three battalions came south in Canberra. Lots of space, good accommodation, room to keep fit and do their training and so on. But you wouldn't dream of sending three battalions in one gigantic white whale into the most vulnerable waters of the thing altogether. So you had to transfer two of the battalions out to elsewhere. Right. Now, on arrival in that area for the cross-decking, we needed to have calm weather